Well, hi everybody, Father Alex here. Welcome to another episode of the Godcast. My guest today on the Godcast is Maxine Kwok. Maxine is the first violinist for the London Symphony Orchestra, and I very much hope you're going to enjoy this conversation, learning about her work and what it's like being in one of the world's leading orchestras. If you enjoy the Godcast, then do check out other episodes. There are hundreds there now, and lots of musicians. And also, you might be interested in my book, which is Our Daily Bread, From Argos to the Altar, which is published by Harper North. That's available online and in all good bookshops. And you might even find me at St. Matthew's Church in Burnley, where I'm the vicar. But for now, I hope you enjoy this interview with Maxine Kwok. Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast this week is Maxine Kwok. Maxine is a first-class violinist, and I'm really excited about talking to you, Maxine. Welcome to the Godcast. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you. It's a bit early for me. I'm not a morning person at all, but otherwise I'm very well, thanks.
Yeah. Anybody listening or watching, we're recording this at 9 o'clock on a damp Wednesday in Burnley. I'm not sure what it's like in London, Maxine, but
it's quite grey.
Is it? Yeah.
It's pretty grey. Yeah.
So the first thing I just want to ask, Maxine, what's it like being in an orchestra? What's the real joy and buzz, and actually some of the difficulties as well?
Gosh, I mean, I loved the whole idea of being in an orchestra from a young age because it was actually making music with friends. That was what really drew me in, because I mean, I first started playing in groups. I mean, I started playing at six, started playing in groups at the age of seven. So that always had this idea that it was fun. And then when I started playing in like symphony orchestras, symphonic repertoire, it was just amazing to hear all these incredible sounds. And I was just like hooked, and that was all I wanted to do. So it's incredibly fun. It's like you feel like you're working as a team. And I suppose I liken it to being, you know, a small cog in a big wheel of a machine. So you're part of something that is kind of much bigger than yourself. So it does mean, though, there is elements of collaboration. You have to, you know, be fairly unselfish in the way that you work, in that I play in the first violin section. That's 16 players. It's, you know, there is a lot of, you know, you have to think about A, the person you're sitting with, and then the wider section, then the strings, and the whole orchestra. So it's many different sort of facets, but as a job, I really, really love it.
And how quickly in your development was it recognised that you were a person with talent? You know, did it come quite quickly?
I suppose so. I joined the National Youth, the National Children's Orchestra at the age of, I guess I was 11. And I think probably at that time, my parents thought, she's getting pretty serious about this. And it opened my eyes, because obviously then you were with kids from all over the country. So you could get a sense of what your peer group was. I am actually from Bromley, and they have a huge, huge youth music department, and they did then. So I was already exposed to a lot of really high quality music education, which was fantastic for me. But to sort of see how things were on a national scale was very interesting. I think from that, I remember from then thinking, this is what I want to do as a career, if one could do this as a career. So it meant work. I did work very hard. I think in those days there were many less distractions. I wouldn't want to hedge my bets on how things would go in this day and age if I had access to a smartphone, more than four channels on TV, etc. But it pretty much from then I thought, I want to be in an orchestra. And that was kind of, I was really glad to have that in my head to kind of fire me forward.
Yeah. And how did that affect your childhood, Maxine? You know, can a lot of kids, certainly around the context where we are in Burnley, you know, traditionally they wouldn't be drawn to classical music. You know, they'd be listening to, I don't know, S Club 7 or Take That or whatever it was. Did that kind of world pass you by, or did the two mix together? How was it?
I was quite lucky. As I said, Bromley has a really, really stellar, strong music youth department. Because I was at my local school, Holy Trinity Convent. It no longer exists, unfortunately. But it was a very small school with very limited music going on. But they were very, very lenient and understanding. So I spent any free time kind of practicing, either going home when I was old enough to just walk the 5 minutes home, or I could practice at school in a free room. So to be honest, school was quite a lonely time for me because it was such a small school, there were not really any like-minded people. But going to the Bromley Youth Music Trust 3 times a week, that gave me the sort of, you know, the you know, your friendships, your sort of fun, all that. So in one sense, it felt like a bit of a lonely path. But in others, I did have friends who were, you know, enjoying music and being very normal kids as well.
Yeah. I've just been recently, I don't know, getting a bit obsessed with Desert Island Discs on Radio 4, and I love kind of the story of music and how it evolves in people's lives. What was the pieces of music that were drawing you in as a child, Maxine? Can you remember those kind of key you know, moments that landed and you thought, wow, this is incredible?
Well, I definitely remember, and all my friends will know this. I come from a family of big Star Wars fans, and I remember hearing the soundtrack to that at home very, very much, and thinking, "Wow, you know." And as a kid, you're not really thinking that much about what it is or who's playing or anything, and. And of course, at some point, I thought this is a symphony orchestra, and they're sort of providing the sound to this film that is so popular, and that had a profound effect on me. Mostly because it put in my mind the London Symphony Orchestra, which is why I ended up where I am. But even, you know, playing works for the first time, like I remember playing Night on Bear Mountain by Mussorgsky and thinking, oh my goodness, this is so exciting. I mean, we must have sounded like a dog's dinner, you know, it was like a group of, you know, very young kids. But things like this, I just had this profound effect on me to make me want to, you know, do this all the time. You know, it's very solitary learning an instrument to a high level. Of course, you spend so much time on your own. Of course, you have to perfecting, you know, the skill, the craft of it. So it was great to do that, but also mix it in with what I thought was tremendous fun to be playing music with other people. And that stands out quite clearly to me when I was young.
Was there ever a rebellious period, Maxine, you know, the teenage years kicked in and, you know, did you just think, oh, I don't want to do this anymore?
I don't actually, it's funny, I don't really think so. I think the most, I was obviously quite driven, which I find quite funny now, because I can be incredibly lazy, but I think there were less distractions in those days. You know, I had this sort of set thing. I practice before school, practice at points during the school day, and I would practice at some point when I got home. But I think probably my rebellious phase was when I was at the Royal Academy of Music, and I had already started doing some professional work when I was 18. Literally just before I went there, I had to miss my first 6 weeks of going to music college. So I never really settled, because I think in that time you make your formative friends, you settle in. I missed, yeah, the first 6 weeks because I was on tour with an orchestra. And from then on, I was a little bit in flux. And I remember saying to my parents, I think I'm going to leave music college. I don't need a degree. I just want to start working, because it was so exciting for me to be already working. And they very much persuaded me that maybe this was a really good idea to get the degree. And because you never know what's going to happen in the future, and that might come in really handy one day. And they're right. That was the only time where I pushed back a bit, I think. But there was never any doubt. I never wanted to do anything else. And I never really felt I was missing out, because, I mean, as I became a later teenager and I was in the National Youth Orchestra, and these were, I would say, and probably the people who were there at the time, these were the best years of my life. And I think it's very different to how things are now, you know, going back 30 years. The friendships you forge, you can't text each other the moment you get home. You had to write letters. Maybe your parents would let you use the landline, you know, once a month to call a friend. So those friendships were very much forged in the music you played, the 2 weeks you spent in the summer holidays. So I was very content and I was very happy, to be honest. So I don't think I ever really, I mean, there were times where I thought, oh, I really can't be bothered to practice, but I think, you know, any kid is like that.
And how's your relationship with the violin evolved over the years, Maxine? I recently interviewed a rock guitarist, a bass guitarist called Rudy Sarzo, who worked with Ozzy Osbourne for many years, and he's in his 70s now, and he's still sort of suggesting that he's still learning every single day about the bass guitar and where he can take it and what he can do with it. Just say a bit about that, Maxine, if you would.
Absolutely, you never stop learning, and it's a physical thing to play an instrument, so it's not something you can just like decide to just have a break. Well, I mean, it's good to have a break because of the muscles and stuff, but it is something that you are still learning, whether it's technically or musically. And certainly when you play in an orchestra, so I'm playing most days for some hours. You don't really always feel like getting your violin out when you get home, because you've been playing a lot and it's not very practical. There's just not enough hours in the day, and you purely just don't feel like it a lot of the time. But you know, there are times you do really still have to either learn some music, keep yourself in shape. Playing in an orchestra means it's very loud, so you don't always hear yourself. So you then need to kind of bring yourself back in playing your own space, so you really hear the sound you're making and make sure that you're really, your intonation is really on point and things like that. So it's an ever evolving process. I'm sure I played differently to how I was when I left music college, and you kind of, I sort of always thought, oh, you know, in those days you probably feel very, you feel bulletproof. You're young, you're playing all the time, you're doing competitions at college, you're auditioning everywhere. But I think, you know, it's also, I've absorbed the most incredible musicality from everyone around me, from the conductors we work with, from the artists we work with, over, you know, the 25-ish years I've been in the profession. So that changes you as a musician as well, and it will just carry on being like that
Yeah.
for the
And
rest of my life.
do you coach and teach yourself, or do you reach out to others for learning, even though you've been a musician for as long as you have?
That was always, teaching was always something I was really scared of. My mum teaches the piano, and she was always like, oh, you might want to teach one day. And I was always like, oh, no. And I was always a bit afraid of, I think it's the kind of imposter syndrome of thinking, like, what can I teach somebody? I don't teach per se, but we do, I do coaching for, you know, the at places like the Royal Academy and the Guildhall School of Music, when they have projects, and they invite players to come and coach the sections. And I have been back and coached at National Children's Orchestra and National Youth Orchestra, and felt so old going back. as a tutor and teaching and thinking, gosh, how I felt as, you know, as a kid there. And it's been so rewarding because I know how important the teaching has shaped me and profoundly at that time. So I've always wanted to give a really, really great experience to those kids, because I know some of them might remember something I said, you know, in 20, 30 years time, or think, oh, that person really kind of inspired me to carry on. And, you know, it's important. It's important to pass things on to future generations, and especially in music at the moment, which is obviously always the first thing that gets cut and underfunded, etc. So to be able to sort of give quality experience and teaching, I think, to kids is just so important.
Yeah. And Maxine, I was my dad was a pianist, a jazz pianist, but he loved classical music, and he loved I remember the violinists, Yehudi Menuhin and Yaka Hyfex. Do those particular musicians still stack up in today's musical world, or has it changed and evolved since then?
I mean, everything changes and evolves, but, oh, I mean, goodness, those are two giants of the playing. I mean, Heifetz is still, I'm sure, the ultimate god for violinists still. The playing in those days was different. It was so individual, very, very individual and unique, and which is why people will still listen to their recordings. When we have countless young artists these days, or and recordings to draw on, people are still listening to people like Menuhin and Heifetz. It's completely, you know, Oistrakh, all these people just sounded so individual. You knew it was them playing the moment you put on their, you know, whether it was a record, a CD, you know, download these days. They are still a huge inspiration for any musician, I think.
Yeah. And can you remember, Maxine, the day where you got the offer to join the London Symphony Orchestra? Can you recall that for us, and how it felt and the emotions that went through your mind?
I remember it very, very clearly, because I was on holiday in Helsinki. In the days before one had, actually, I did have a mobile phone that was, you know, the size of a brick, but you didn't take it abroad. It probably wouldn't have worked abroad. So the orchestra, the chair at the time, was trying to contact me, not, you know, reaching me. Ended up calling my parents, who managed to speak to me, you know, in Helsinki, and said, oh, apparently, you know, you got the LSO job. And I was just so, I'll never forget that moment. It was just the best feeling, because I wanted a job there for so long. And, you know, with any job, there's always an element of, you know, you have to work hard for it, but also you just sometimes need a bit of luck to be in the right place at the right time for things to just fall into place. And it was, it was the best feeling in the world. I mean, it's a really long time ago, but I still remember feeling just like I couldn't believe it had actually happened. And obviously, you know, it was funny that it was my parents who had to sort of tell me. And I think they almost didn't answer the phone at home, because they were like, who's this? So I'm glad they sort of did.
And I would imagine, I was trying to think what listeners or viewers want to ask. And I'm intrigued to know, what is a working week like for Maxine Kwok? You know, is it, you know, I suppose people just think, oh, you just rock up at the, you know, the various auditoriums or theatres, and you do your stuff and you go home. I know it's not like that. But what is it like, Maxine?
Gosh, I get asked this question quite a lot. Oh, what's a sort of typical week? And I can safely say that no 2 weeks are ever the same. They're very, very, very varied, which is what makes, I think, for me, the job so exciting and interesting. Obviously, you have your concerts. So the LSO is based at the Barbican Centre in London. So, you know, we have 50 concerts in there a year. You know, we play at the proms in the summer, which is wonderful. We might play, you know, a couple of weeks ago we played at the Bristol Beacon. So we do a couple of two or three sort of out of town dates, whether, you know, it's Bristol, Bath, or Brighton. I don't know, Birmingham. It's all the B's for some reason. But interspersed with all that is a huge two huge portions of our work, one of which is international travel touring, and the other, which is commercial work. So international touring can be 80 concerts a year, for example. You know, we have residencies in different places. You know, we have a big trip to the Far East further in the year, to America next year, and we're generally traveling to Europe most months. And in the middle of that, we're in the studios, you know, Abbey Road Studios, or our own LSO St. Luke's is a studio, and we're recording anything from classical music to film scores to game music scores, projects which people bring to us. They want their music recorded, backing tracks for pop albums. So it's really very, very diverse and eclectic. So there's never really a set kind of time, which I think some people, it can be a bit challenging. You know, it's not Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 at all. But for me, it's always been interesting for me to, oh, what are we doing this week? Anything? Oh, that looks interesting. And you don't quite know what it is until you actually get there and you sit down and you look at the music. So it's really could be anything.
And what happens to the dynamic in music backscene? I'm a ridiculous, silly fan of Depeche Mode, who historically are, kind of dark electro music, but they've worked with orchestras over the years, and I always wonder what it's like for the person in the orchestra to adapt from a traditional classical piece to something more contemporary and that maybe wasn't originally written in any way for an orchestra.
It's an interesting question. I think certainly in London, orchestras are massively flexible because we are so used to working with different types of music, different types of groups. And I mean, my teacher at the Royal Academy of Music, Eric Grunberg, I mean, he played on the original Beatles albums. You know, lots of, you know, as musicians, we're formatted to sort of get ourselves into the different modes of playing. So, you know, if you're playing Mozart, Beethoven, and suddenly you find yourself, you know, accompanying some hard rock and things like that, you kind of have to slip into this genre and very fast, especially if it's one thing if you're preparing for a concert, but another thing if you're recording, which will start the moment, you know, you sit down. So I think it's something that London musicians are very attuned to and very aware of, because we never really know what to expect. We've learned to adapt very, very quickly, and also, you know, for all these projects, generally you have to wear headphones, and it can feel like a very strange experience the first time it kind of happens. And you know, you're hearing a beat in the headset, you're not necessarily even in the same room as, say, a band. They'll probably be separated out, so they can get things into the mix. So it's all a very much a learning process, but you learn very fast, that's for sure.
And what about conductors, Maxime? What you know, I'm not a trained musician, and I often wonder what difference a conductor makes to a piece of music. What you know, how do different conductors make orchestras sound slightly different or radically different?
That's another question that I get asked a lot. Like, what does that person even do? Are they actually useful? Because nobody seems to be looking at them. Yeah, they are very, very different. They are pretty essential. I mean, ultimately, they're there to keep time, because you know, you might have 90 people on stage, a vast stage, and from a practical point of view, the sound from one side of the stage is not going to hit at the same time as the other side. So with the best will in the world, the listening is not going to work in those situations. And the conductor then adds their own elements of musicality onto the music that we're performing. And being in an orchestra, it can be tough at times because, you know, we have strong opinions. You're brought up, you play on your own, you form your own musical ideas, and suddenly you're in a situation where you follow someone else's ideas ultimately. But that is the challenge of it and the beauty of it. And they all bring something very, very different to concerts. Some of them like to rehearse a lot, so they talk a lot and they like to have everything completely sort of ready for the concert, so there's no surprise. Others are much more spontaneous. Things change in the concert. You have to be so aware. Some of them are very technical, so their baton movements are really precise and beautiful. Others, you look at them and you think, I wouldn't know, you know, they're shaping the music, and you have to find a way to kind of understand that language. They're very, it's a completely different breed of person, if you like, but very essential for us. And of course, as with everything, people have their favourites, people they don't like, etc. But it's quite a fascinating sort of world to watch. And I do, yeah, I find it very interesting that two people can conduct a piece, you know, the day or day after, and it could be 100% different.
Yeah. And something I really want to ask you, Maxine, is about the kind of the spiritual connection. I mean, this is the Godcast, and next week is Holy Week for Christians. And you know, I'm thinking of St. John's Passion Box, St. John's Passion. The audiences are often moved. I can be moved by classical music, or I can be moved by rock music. It doesn't really matter to me. If it touches me in my heart, it can really move me. What's it like when you're playing? Are you moved when you're playing, or are you so engaged in what you're doing that you don't have that opportunity to feel that?
I'm never failed to be moved. I mean, there's lots of music that I love and adore playing. So I think it's impossible to play. And if it's something that is, you know, obviously there's times I end up playing music I'm not that keen on. But if you're playing something that, for example, this weekend we play Mahler 5, one of my favourite pieces to play, the music is so beautiful and so heart-wrenching, and just makes you feel something, a connection to everybody around you. And for me, it's much more about actively participating in it. I realized that because I went to a concert last week of my own orchestra. I happened to be off and, you know, spent my free evening going to see my own orchestra play. But I think it's always a nice thing to support your colleagues and also to hear your own orchestra from a distance. And I enjoyed the concert, but I realized that I get this joy and love of playing very much from actively participating on stage and feeling like, I don't know, it's, you feel really at one, like one team, one animal when you're on stage in that way, and it creates this sort of magic. And I imagine intensely spiritual for people who listen and people who play as well. It is hard to put into words this connection that one feels from your own self, your instrument, to the music, to everybody around you. But it is totally what drives me and why I still love and feel as fresh about the job,
yeah,
as I did, you know, 24 years ago.
And you must have played in some of the most extraordinary settings. Are there a couple that come to mind, Maxine, where you think, where, you know, there were those almost awe and wonder moments, where, because quite often the venue can enhance the concert, can't it? I can think of venues where, mm-hmm, my goodness me, this is just magical. Are there a few that stick in your mind, or?
There are, yeah. I mean, it's always special to play at the Proms, the Royal Albert Hall, of course. It's a vast venue. Okay, it's not in a way, it's almost too big to it's, because it's, you know, you're on stage and it's just ginormous space. That's a very, very special feeling, always to play there, as kind of this wonderment of, and of course, because the Proms is such a special festival that's so historic. Oh, there are so many beautiful places around the world. I mean, I have my favorite halls, you know, whether they're in, you know, Madrid and Tokyo, places like that. There's a beautiful outdoor setting in Granada at the Palau there, which it's, I don't really like outdoor concerts because it comes with its own challenges. There's always, you know, the wind, and you have to wait for it to be, you know, cool enough.
Flame
enough.
Flying
but, yeah, there's always, you know, something that happens. Obviously, I suppose I get the biggest buzz out of our, we play a free concert every summer in Trafalgar Square for basically 10,000 people. You know, to be under sort of Nelson's Column, looking out onto that square from a stage, that always gives me a bit of a kind of goosebump effect, to know you're playing in a place that kind of doesn't usually have music, which is, and we play a concert, and obviously you might get, you know, sightseeing buses honking and all sorts of sounds of London around you. That's a very, very special kind of occasion for us, because you, especially because it's free and you're able to sort of like give music to people who might not be able to come to a concert, a normal concert in a hall.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thanks for sharing that with us. And something I also want to ask, I mean, I feel like I've been on a real whistle-stop tour, but I'm so fascinated by it all. Just the issue of whether, you know, classical music is for a certain class of people, you know. I work in a very deprived part of Lancashire in Burnley, and very traditionally working class. Can you just tell me about what the orchestra does to kind of break down those cliches or barriers to, you know, because I what you said right at the beginning was that music is usually the first thing to go, you know. I think I totally agree with that, and I'm really sad that schools don't seem to have, in provincial places such as Burnley, have that real almost necessity for music. You know, I think music is such a great healer on so many different levels, but it does seem to be falling by the wayside. Just tell us a bit about what the orchestra does to kind of break those barriers down.
Absolutely. It's the most important part, probably, apart from being on stage, of what we do. So, I mean, for anyone who wants to read more, if they go to the website, and it's LSO Discovery, that's our education department. Because if you cannot give music to everybody, that's, you know, it's all very well for the people who can afford to come to concerts. You know, we want to engage young people. And I was really lucky with the start I got. I ended up, you know, living in a place which offered a lot of free music education, and obviously a lot of kids, it's just not possible now. So we have many education programs in the orchestra, things like Next Generation on track, and we draw in local boroughs, of which most are, you know, not wealthy boroughs at all, where music education is super limited. They probably don't have access to instruments. And we try and, you know, we're able to go out and teach them at the schools, bring them all together to play at LSO St. Luke's, different projects, so that they will get to meet each other and create something, whether we're making a piece together or something is specifically written for them, and hopefully encourage a way for them to be inspired to move on with music. And, you know, we offer a pathways, opportunities for diverse musicians who, you know, I think just want to have the opportunity to have sort of started with some music and really want an opportunity to carry on. And it's just not possible because of where they are, their, you know, socioeconomic status, the fact that you know, they come from a neighborhood which doesn't support any classical music. So these things for us are just essential, because if people don't get the opportunity to start, then they're very unlikely to make classical music part of their lives. And it's not about making sure that there's people in the profession one day. It's just, I think we all know that music just is such, as you say, a healer, an enricher. You know, we have a big project where people go into schools and special needs schools and hospitals, because it's music can be a real balm for the soul. It's just makes people, you know, whether it brings out some emotions and it just gives you a sense of calm. I mean, I realized this very much during the pandemic when we couldn't work. And the hardest thing obviously was not going to work, but I sort of thought, oh, life feels very quiet suddenly. And I don't usually listen to classical music at home at all, because I think I'm doing that all day. And suddenly I found myself listening to classical music all the time at home, because I hadn't realized how much I needed it to make me, you know, feel that sort of emotions and feel connected and things. So it's absolutely of vital importance. And it's absolutely shocking how limited music is these days in schools, and a real tragedy for these generations. So we, you know, with the LSO, we try to do as much as we can. You know, there's only so much one can do without, you know, the help of from a much, much, much larger source. But, you know, if we can encourage and inspire kids, I mean, I just saw one that I'd sort of coached and seen at different projects since he was a youngster. And I happened to go to a concert and saw students at Trinity Laban playing in Greenwich. And I saw one of them there and I said, I'm so happy, you know, you're at music college and stuff. And he's like, yeah. And it was like, I thought, oh, you're all grown up. And it was just like, you know, but that was a wonderful thing to think somebody that, you know, with the challenges already, but they've been inspired to push on through. Yeah. And it often needs the support, you know, the family and everything, because it's not cheap and it involves a lot of support and from, you know, families to take you to your lessons, to pay for your lessons, etc. So it is of vital importance.
Yeah. And people who might be watching or listening to this, Maxine, thinking, oh gosh, I need to go and listen to some classical music. I need to go and where would you tell them to start?
The sort of repertoire, or where, I mean, obviously these days, you know, Apple Music Classical, they're with LSOs all over that. And we have our label, which is celebrating its 25th year, which I can barely believe, LSO Live, which takes our live concerts and puts them into recordings, which are fantastic. There are some amazing recordings there. And I always say to people, you know, if you're foraying into classical music and you know, the thing is, a lot of people always think like, oh, don't know if it's for me, you know, it sounds all a bit highbrow. I mean, chances are you're hearing classical music all the time, whether it's on the TV, from adverts, and a lot of people like to get in through, you know, I always think if you like film music, you know, if you like Star Wars, if you love, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Harry Potter, I'm naming all the things that the LSO have recorded, then you're going to love music by Richard Strauss, William Walton, Prokofiev. You're going to hear all those things, you know, all exactly the same, similar sort of ways that the music will bring images to you. And, you know, I often say, you know, if you don't know classical music, you know, listen to Debussy's La Mer. It's about the sea. It's three movements and you can totally hear what the composer wanted. It's very accessible. I think a lot of people think, oh, I wouldn't know where to start. And you don't have to love Mozart, Beethoven and Brahms. And sorry, these are not my favorite composers either. There's just a wealth of things one can listen to. And, you know, and if you're in London, you just have an incredible choice of concerts to listen to, and you know, but firstly, it's just totally there on the radio, on your phone.
Yeah. Maxine, I really, really thoroughly enjoyed chatting to you. Thanks so much for coming on. And I just want to, final question is, I interviewed a guy called Jonathan Antoine, who's an opera singer who likes his classical music, but away from that, he's a big lover of thrash metal. What's your go away from classical music? What's your kind of go-to genre? What floats your boat?
Oh goodness. Probably, gosh, stuff from my childhood then. Yeah, if one sort of went through my phone, you'd probably find sort of 80s and 90s pop, which would be really embarrassing. But there's something, I think when you reach my age, you kind of, there's an element of nostalgia. So I at the moment I'm quite into listening to yeah, the sort of pop music from my youth, which is quite funny. And you know, I tend to listen to, if I listen to classical music, I'll listen to piano music actually, rather than anything violin related. Yeah, I think that's too much of a busman's holiday otherwise. But yes, but no thrash metal for me, as of 35. But you know, and if I, you know, and obviously, yeah, just I love listening to, say, like Ella Fitzgerald and like that, you know, who wouldn't?
Absolutely. Well, I do hope everybody's enjoyed this interview with Maxine. If you like musicians particularly, there's loads on the Godcast. Just go check them out from all different genres. But Maxine, thanks so much for coming on, and it's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.